standing ground. We shall fight in the field.
Statsbøttekottet.
Hei og velkommen til en ny serie om komparativ politikkdelen av Politusen. Med oss i studio for hele denne serien postdoktor Kathleen Jennings.
Postdoktor Jennings foreleser for KP-delen av Politusen og amerikansk. Vi har derfor bestemt oss for at denne serien spilles inn på engelsk.
God fornøyelse.
Statsbøttekottet.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Statsbøttekottet with me, Lars, and Andreas.
This is one of four episodes in the summary podcast series in Poll 1000 for comparative politics. This podcast series will try to summarize the syllabus on the subject. The series is not intended as a substitute for reading the syllabus, but as a supplement.
During this series, we will cover the topics key concepts and state formation, Möller's control logic, forms of rule and ideology, and state structure and governance.
For this series, we are proud to have Kathleen Jennings, postdoctor and lecturer in Poll 1000, as our guest. Postdoctor Jennings has studied both at Stanford and Oxford, and she took her doctorate in political science at the University of Oslo. She's lecturing here at NTNU in Poll 1000, Comparative Politics. Welcome to our podcast, Postdoctor Jennings.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Thank you.
The theme for this episode is key concepts and state formation. Before starting on the theme for this episode, we would like to ask you, since this is the first episode in our Comparative Politics summary series, what is comparative politics and how is it different from international politics?
Great. There really is, the differences are not that big, honestly. You have comparative politics and international relations as the two kind of most closely related, I would say, subfields of political science. But the main difference is basically that international politics is very much looking at institutions and phenomenon that cross international borders. So if you look at, for example, the United Nations, which is an international organization to which, of course, all countries are member states. You look at lots of questions around conflict, war, the conduct of diplomacy and of international politics, again, where you have different state actors or organizations or institutions interacting together and how they interact. Whereas comparative politics is, as it says in the name, more about comparing the same things in different contexts. So what that means from a political science standpoint is, for example, comparing how institutions are the same or differ across contexts, how electoral systems have different variations and outcomes or favor certain outcomes across systems. So what you're doing is you have these building blocks, these institutional and to some extent cultural building blocks that you are finding in all these states or at the sub-state level, for example, at the sort of more localized levels. And you're studying these, and then you're comparing how they play out in other places and what these differences are and what those differences can tell us about, for example, how democracies function or how certain phenomena come to be and have the outcomes they have.
Yeah. As mentioned earlier, the first theme is key concepts. Firstly, could you define what the state means in the context of comparative politics?
So, I mean, the state is the building block of the international system. And the basic kind of our understanding of the state is very much about having an entity that has a territory and has a government that has the authority to rule. So we're talking about, I mean, and that's a very kind of minimalist basic definition of the state, but we're talking about a territory, a people, and a regime or authority that has the ability to, not just the ability, but the authority to rule. And so what that basically means is that we're not talking about sort of powers that are not geographically rooted anywhere. So not talking about like organized crime, for example, that might be able to move around. We're not talking about Places like Somaliland, for example, is not technically a state because it has many of these things, but it doesn't have the sort of recognized boundaries. So there are some things that sort of seem like they should be states but aren't, or vice versa. But what we're generally talking about most fundamentally is a territory with a population, with borders, and with a government that can, that has the authority to rule.
Okay, so Max Weber is obviously an important person in our learning. How does he define the state?
I mean, a lot of what I just said is sort of building on the sort of Weber's understanding of the state. And the only thing that I would add in specifically with Weber is this notion of the state having the or the monopoly on the use of legitimate violence within the state, which basically means, not to say that there isn't, that only the state uses or controls violence in the state, but the key in that definition is legitimate. So only the state can have exercise violence in a legitimate way. And here he's talking specifically sort of military and police authorities, right? And so if you have basically on the Weber definition is that if a different, a non-state authority controls, for example, the use of military power, that would push on his definition of a state. Now, in modern terms, we would say that that doesn't sort of undefine a state. We would say that that is a state that has failed, that has sort of collapsed. But in the Weber terms, it was very clear to him that having that kind of control over the exercise of violence in the legitimate way was a very key factor of being a state. And then he had different ideal types around states, but the state itself was a very similar definition to what I said in the previous question.
Part of Weber's definition is the concept of legitimacy, right? How do we define legitimacy in this context?
I mean, the way political scientists tend to define legitimacy is that is to often see it sort of in connection to the notion of authority. So authority is the ability to rule. A government can have the authority to rule because they control the instruments of power. Legitimacy is kind of a step beyond that. Legitimacy is the general acceptance of the authority to rule, right? So a government can be perceived as legitimate by its people without being democratically elected. For example, in China, China has widely perceived as a legitimate, having a legitimate government that is not a democratic place. You could have other situations where governments are perceived as illegitimate, even though they are democratically elected. You've seen certain tendencies in the United States, for example. But generally, the connection between legitimacy and authority is that legitimacy is that there's a general acceptance that that government has a right to exercise its power. And you could also say with respect to a state, but usually it's connected to a regime rather than government, or is respected to connected to a regime rather than a state.
Okay, so we've talked about what makes a state, but why do we really have these states?
I mean, this is kind of the point of the Mullard book in a way. Mullard was very, or is trying to sort of go through the sort of intellectual history around why, in particular, European states form the way they do. And, I mean, the basic answer why we have a state is because a state is the most, in a way, effective means of political organization. But how you went from these sort of small localized kingdoms, or in some cases, huge empires, into a system, the state system we have today, that's in a way a sort of a different question. But ultimately, the system kind of landed on states as the most effective means of organizing populations.
Yeah. We can jump to the last question there. As you said, Mueller attempts to not kind of answer this question, but explore this question in his book. What are the main things he looks at in exploring this question?
So, I mean, Mullard is not himself trying to reinvent the wheel. So he's not necessarily coming up with any new answers. What Mullard is trying to do is lay out for the reader how some of the kind of great classic scholarship in sort of political science slash sociology has answered or tried to answer these questions about how the European state developed as it did, how democracy, particularly within Europe, sort of developed the way it did and how it became consolidated, and then connecting this with capitalism. And so Mullen is basically taking us through three main kind of groupings of scholars, you might call them like schools, on these questions, connected to a specific time period. So you have Weber and his kind of gang around the sort of late 1800s, early 1900s. You have this other group, more in them in the sort of 60s, a lot of these sort of Marxists and neo-Marxists. And then you have a later group, so Scopel and Tilly and this gang. And what kind of binds them all together is they're all looking at these questions in ways that tend to connect because they're sort of in dialogue with each other over time as well. And so what he's kind of pulling out is that, I mean, if you were to take a kind of headline story from Mullard, it would be that European states and European democracies developed the way they did because of a very kind of specific cultural, religious, and sort of political legacy from dating all the way back from, you know, the ancient Greeks and the Romans, and then through the medieval times. And you have this sort of history of the way that states developed connected very much to sort of both like legacies of the church, well, not just legacies of, but the situation of especially the Catholic Church in Europe, connected to feudalism, which was a means of political and social organization in the Middle Ages, and connected to the need for monarchs to be able to fund their wars. And so what Mullet is basically trying to kind of remind us is that the way that states developed in Europe is by no means inevitable, and it's not easily replicable. So there's a lot of sort of historical and cultural elements that come in here, which have a lot of different explanations, but ended up in a situation where you have a lot of these sort of pre-states making these bargains between the kind of monarch or the king and the aristocracy and the sort of merchant classes. So he's taking us through how different scholars have understood these bargains and what they mean in terms of how the king gives up power to some degree, or not power, gives some sort of bargain to the sort of landowning classes in exchange for money, and then uses that to fund wars. And that these wars then create the need for soldiers, which means conscription, which means an expansion of eventually rights, the bargain gets expanded. So it's this long process that, again, in the European context is quite unique because there was no big one huge empire like in China. You had lots of smaller entities fighting it out amongst themselves over a long period of time. So what I would say what the headline for Mullet is that by looking at how different scholars have sort of approached the question of state formation, he is trying to pull out what these scholars have in common, where they agree, where they disagree, and also the kind of unique components of the European example that, again, have a sort of explanatory function for how states developed and also may or may not be replicable to places that are still struggling with democratic formation now, for example.
This was a little bit about key concepts and state formation in comparative politics. There are three other parts in this to this series covering Müller and his control logic, forms of rule and ideology, and state structures and governance.
Excellent.
Thank you very much for the talk, Postdoctor Jennings. This conversation has certainly helped me a lot.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
And then we wonder if you have any like general tips for the exam or the exam time.
I mean, my general tip would be, besides do the reading and look at the lecture notes, which are very comprehensive, the slides, there's a lot of words, would be not to get hung up on very small details. Without saying what's going to be on the exam, I can say that there's not going to be any kind of trick questions that if you haven't read page 72 of Mulid, you're not going to be able to answer the question. Like, we're not trying to trap people. What we're trying to do is test sort of if you have a solid understanding of some of these basic concepts and the sort of basic sort of what we've been discussing here in terms of institutions, in terms of some of the historical stuff, in terms of some of the methods, and can just sort of relate to these things in a sort of comprehensive enough way that shows that you have actually understood what's in the pensum, what we've been talking about in the lectures. But you don't need to know like all the very, very, very details. The main thing is to be able to tell a story about how all these things hang together and to understand how the different parts of these systems work sort of in concert or sort of pull against each other.
We hope this has been helpful for the exam study, and thank you for listening. We want you to remind you again that the curriculum podcasts cannot replace reading, but are intended to supplement the busy exam period.
We also recommend following along because this podcast series has several other parts.
Statsbøttekottet. Statsbøttekottet.